This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people, dishes, and ingredients decolonizing food. We're looking at our Thanksgiving plates and beyond to explore efforts to reclaim food sovereignty in Native American culture, the African diaspora, and Puerto Rico.
I believe that oyster dressing is like the consummate side dish for an amazing fried turkey.
What we're doing there is just working the land, and we're laughing, and we're creating a space for joy. And it's in that healing occurs for us.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
So on this episode of Soul by Todd Richards, I have a great friend. I call him a youngin' because he's definitely younger than me. Greg Collier on our podcast this week, and a little history about Greg. You know, he has this wonderful breakfast spot called the Yolk Club in Charlotte. But his latest venture, Leah Louise, along with his wife Sabrina, who I can definitely tell you is the better of the two. She's the better half in that relationship. But Leah and Louise is called a modern juke joint. And it's the latest concept from James Beard nominated Chef Gregory Collier. The menu features modern interpretations of Southern classics that honor Mississippi River Valley foodways that include Memphis, Jackson, Mississippi, and New Orleans. So, youngin', Greg, Chef, welcome to the show.
I appreciate you having me, OG, man. Look, hey. You call me youngin' as long as you need to.
Yeah, well, you know, I can call you youngin' before, but when you have two restaurants, that kind of takes you out of the youngin' category. you know, I mean, because running two definitely requires to have some experience as well as some intestinal fortitude in order to do two at the same time. So you have left the youngin', but I still put you over my knee. It makes you feel any better, you know?
Hey, man, look, I'll take it, man. I'll take it.
So what's going on? You are in Charlotte, but that's not where you're from. Where are you from originally again?
Born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. You know, I know you from Chicago, so it's like I've always kind of been your little brother because I always see Chicago as kind of big brother to Memphis anyway, so... you know, we those similarities kind of run through the Mississippi River.
What kind of food did you eat there?
So it's wild, right? Everybody talks about Memphis barbecue. And we definitely ate a lot of barbecue. Everybody cooked it, but like I ate a lot of I guess you call it Meat 3 soul food when I was coming up. You know, fried chicken, fried fish, grilled chicken, a lot of smoked meats with a lot of different sides. So I guess I ate the traditional soul food coming up. And then, of course, like a lot of fast food because that's just, you know, high schoolers. That's all we did.
Right. Okay. Of course. So you left Memphis in what year?
So I left Memphis in 2007. I was working at a mom and pop hot wing spot. I wanted to kind of get out of Memphis to find out who I was because in Memphis, I'm a Memphian. And that's all I am. You know what I'm saying? That's what I am. And I couldn't really understand who I was outside of that. So I left Memphis to go to culinary school to take the kind of food world a little seriously. I went to Scottsdale, Arizona, which was nothing like Memphis. When I tell you, like,
definitely not,
Memphis.
You know.
Yeah. I understand.
Maybe only in temperature, but culturally, you are in a whole different world, my friend, there. Yeah.
Whole different world. I had to try to find my lane out there because back home, you know, it's 55% African-American in Memphis. I think it was like 15 in Arizona, and then like Scottsdale was like 3%. So it was a total culture shock going up to Arizona.
So going to school, going to culinary school, where you don't, you know, there's a big question happening right now about culinary school. Do you go? Do you not go? Is it worth the cost of tuition? What was your experience? Do you think that you really benefited from going to culinary school?
So one of the conversations that you and I have had and like Keith Rose, Dwayne Nutter. Like, I've always called y'all my OGs and my mentors because I watched y'all from afar. Had I had a relationship where I worked for one of y'all, I wouldn't need to go to culinary school because of how much y'all learned from y'all mentors. But for me, I didn't have a mentor, so it was important for me to kind of go and get a baseline to kind of understand about proper cookery, proper techniques, how to put things together, learn how to do flavors. And I moved out there to go to Le Cordon Bleu, but my financial aid didn't go through, and I ended up going to the community college program, which I paid $10,000 for the entire program plus the associate's degree part of it. So for me, that was a lot of value in going to culinary school.
Well, most people, I agree that, you know, unless you work in a restaurant first, I don't recommend going to culinary school. Right. But, you know, you did have some experience in restaurant beforehand. So finding those values or finding those cooking methods in culinary school probably helped you further your career more than most who go straight from, you know, out of high school or have a whole nother career and then head to culinary school after that. I always recommend, you know, working in the restaurant first before you commit to spending that type of money.
You got to know, because the restaurant industry is wild. I mean, it's wild in good ways, it's wild in bad ways. All of those ways kind of, you know, develop who you are, develop their character, whatever. So I think you need to know that you love the industry before you go and spend $40,000-$50,000 trying to find out if you love the industry and then finding out you don't love the industry. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of money, because you really should really have a passion for doing what we do. And you don't really find that out of culinary school, because culinary school for a lot of people is just like playing around with other people's food and other people's money. You don't really find out what it is until it's your money on the line. Or what kind of language is this PG-13? I need to know how I can talk on here.
it's definitely, I would say PG-13, but it depends on how much bourbon we have, you know, by the time we finish this conversation. But, you know, let me ask you a different question inside of this. Is that, did you work while you were going to culinary school?
Yeah. So crazy, right? So I was working, when I was working at the hot wing spot, Ching's Hot Wings in Memphis, Tennessee, when I was working at the hot wing spot, I obviously kind of started off like everybody, washing dishes or whatever. I got to a point to where financially it wasn't a good thing, so I was working at a warehouse. The reason why I picked Scottsdale is because I was going to get a job transfer from that warehouse to another place, to another warehouse in the same kind of vein. So I moved there on a job transfer, and it was wow. So I went to culinary school from 7 to 3, and I was working from 6 p.m. to 4 a.m. in the morning. And it's so crazy in Arizona. I was driving to school when I was supposed to be at work, and I was driving to work when I was supposed to be at school, because the sun and everything kind of looks the same around that time in Phoenix. So, yes, I definitely worked and went to school, but at some point I had to figure out a way to kind of navigate it better. But I worked the whole time I was in school.
So it's kind of like owning two restaurants of your own right now. You still work all the time. You know, people ask, well, how do you develop a work ethic? Well, it first starts with actually working, you know, in order to get that work ethic, you know. So you left Arizona, and where did you head after that?
Oh, I moved from Arizona. It got to a place to where I knew working for other chefs wasn't going to give me my skill set was good, and I could cook, right? And I knew I could cook, but I needed to create. So we actually, her parents were in Somerville, so we lived in Somerville for 2 hours, I mean, for 2 months, and we drove back and forth from Charleston to Charlotte looking for jobs. And I started at a couple places while I was down in Charleston just kind of figure out what I wanted to do. I just knew I had something to say. From Charleston, we found like this hole-in-the-wall spot in Rock Hill, 1,200 square feet, green carpet on the floors, green boots. And I was like, yeah, I can't do fine dining in here. I got to do something simple like a breakfast spot. So that's how we ended up doing the breakfast restaurant. And our first original location was in Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is like 20 minutes south of Charlotte.
Okay, so you bring up an interesting point about your selection in restaurants, because most people would not consider your first nomination was really for the Yolk Club. Am I correct? Yep. So most people would not consider that haute cuisine, but you still got nominated for a Beard Award. So tell me more about this breakfast exploration that got you nominated for a Beard Award.
So, I mean, when I think about cooking and I think about food, I think about my roots, and my direct roots are my parents. So, you know, going to culinary school, I kind of learned about different techniques and different food. And then when I kind of moved back to the South, I kind of found farm to table, which is odd because my grandma and my mom and all of they all ate farm to table. So kind of reemerging and rediscovering farm to table gave me my impetus on how I wanted to cook. I knew going into a small town, there's no way I could cook. I mean, just for like, they don't want duck. They don't want foie. They don't even really want a medium rare steak, right? So I knew that I was going to have to do something that allowed me to convince people to eat a little different. And I figured breakfast was easy because if I can put butternut squash in a pancake, I can put butternut squash in anything else. But you can trust me with putting it in a pancake for $6 versus me trying to sell you a composed butternut squash dish for maybe like $10 or $15. So our thought process was like that we're gonna go in simple. We're gonna start with the easiest meal of the day, something that everybody can get around, and we're just gonna locally source stuff and we're gonna cook from scratch. And that was just like the beginning baseline. And we knew that we were always gonna keep building flavors and keep trying different techniques and kind of bringing our southern palate to South Carolina in a different way. So like, be clear. I thought I was like, yo, I'm gonna do like a 40 seat restaurant. We're gonna do like this high end food, and everybody's gonna love it. Everybody's gonna eat it. But when we walked into the restaurant, it was like hot dogs on the grill still, like literal hot dogs sitting on the grill, ketchup, and I was like, yeah, it's no way I can be creative as I want to here, at least at first. So I think we use breakfast as kind of the Trojan horse to kind of get into the food scene in Charlotte.
So let's talk about this in even further detail, because one thing I don't believe that people understand about two things, one fried chicken, two scrambling or cooking eggs, is that proper technique is required in order to make the best of those things. It's not like you just crack an egg, scramble it, and put it in the hottest pan. Most people, will do that, and that's why their eggs you can bounce off of floor, because they're so hard. So really, going back to culinary school or going back to your grandmother's kitchens where you talked about cooking, where did the seeking of knowledge of techniques come from? Like, was that instilled for you from your grandmother, or is that just something that you saw on television? Where did that seeking of knowledge come from?
So it's weird for me, right? Like, most chefs have the grandmother story and how, they were always in the kitchens and they grew up and they kind of learned through the way. Then they went to culinary school. It's weird for me because I found out after I went to culinary school how much I had been in the kitchen, how much, because I really can't remember, spending time in the kitchen with my granny or whatever. But as I kind of went to culinary school, all my aunts and uncles, they're like, yeah, of course, you're a chef. Like, we knew you were going to be a chef. And I was like, it's no way I knew I was going to be a chef. It was like, nah, like, you was always in the kitchen, always helping granny bake, always helping with the butter rolls, the biscuits, all these things. And I was like, there's no way I was doing that. But now as I get back in, like, as I, do more and try to find the roots and look through, look to find my granny essentially through cooking, I realized and recognized that that's something that I've always done. So I think for me, I'm just kind of that person, right? Like, I'm always trying to find a way to skirt around the rules or a way to, so do you have to do it like that? Or are you just saying you got to do it like that because that's the only way you know how to do it, right? So I'm always trying to, I think chefs essentially we are all counterculture, right? We always trying to find a way to do something different or better or bigger or smaller, whatever, right? We're always trying to find a way to do different. So I think my personality led me to that. But once I got to culinary school, I saw like, hey, this roux and this bechamel, this is milk gravy. Right. I noticed, you know what I'm saying? But I didn't know that that's what it was. I just was putting those pieces together. So I think for me, connecting the dots happened in culinary school. And I realized that my granny was doing all this stuff. I just didn't know that that's what she was doing at first. The standard breading procedure, you go flour, egg yolk, breadcrumbs. It's the same. My granny's been doing that for years. It just was flour, buttermilk, flour. I just didn't I had to connect the dots to understand the technique that I had always seen my whole life.
And it's funny, too, in commanding the price for culinary school, you got all that training for free with definitely more love from your right. grandmother than probably your instructor.
1,000%.
Yeah. So when you have the Yoke Club, but you also had a series where you really brought together a whole group of Black chefs. And tell us what inspired you to have that series, bringing all these chefs together, producing this wonderful food that everyone is still waiting, for COVID to end so they can all get back in the same kitchen with you again.
So, man, honestly, I'll more than once call you my OG and my mentor, because I saw, first of all, I saw Joe Randall and Daryl Evans, like people who, y'all talk about all the time as people to look to. They were doing Black Chef series, in the 90s. I was doing this early 2000s. So for me, it was just trying to figure out how to fit in the kind of puzzle that was already being built. But more than anything, because I didn't have a mentor until I reached out to you, until I kind of reached out to Dwayne and Keith, right? I didn't have personal mentors. I knew that was something that I wanted to make sure I could be for the next generation of Black chefs, right? I wanted to make sure that if they had questions about opening restaurants, techniques, recipes, decorum, what's actually supposed to happen in the kitchen versus what was going on in the kitchen, I wanted to make sure that I could be that. And I also wanted to get in the kitchens with other brothers and sisters and just be in a space where I felt comfortable and I felt loved, like how I felt in my granny's kitchen learning, just at a different place. So we kind of started that. We started Soul Food Sessions just to really be in the same kitchen together and cook together. Once we saw it happen and we saw how good the food was and we saw how great the reception was, we realized that we can make a big difference in the culinary community here and afar. And any reason that I get to call any people that I've looked up to for my culinary career, right? Black chefs, they say, you want to go cook? And it's like, let's do it. Let's cook together. Let's figure this out. I'm like, yo, any reason to do that is a win for me. So everything about Soul Food Sessions really is just about the extended family that you kind of lose when you leave home, right? Big brothers, uncles, cousins, big sisters, mm-hmm. mother figures. Like, I found all these things in Soul Food Sessions working with different chefs and learning through those processes. So all those things is why we did Soul Food Sessions.
I mean, it really is great when I believe I saw one with 7 courses. And it's gotten to it over 9 courses. Am I yep. correct?
And the first one was 4 courses.
Right. Yep. I mean, and if anyone knows, my history with Chef Dwayne and Jerry Slater at the Oak Room, our first tasting menu was only 5 courses. And when we left, it was 20. So they're always, that exploration of how to do things more in sync and having more fun, but also challenging ourselves to be better every day. And for you to be a mentor to people are at such a still age of where you are is not only inspiring to most, but it's also a noteworthy story of how to persevere in this restaurant business. We're going to take a small break right here and have some sponsors come in and talk to you guys, and we'll be right back with a good friend of mine, the youngin, as I call him, Chef Gregory Collier.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's L-A-R-D-E-R, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
All right, so we're back here with Chef Gregory Collier, and we were talking about his pathway from Memphis to Arizona to a little bit south of Charlotte, opening the Yolk Club Soul Food Sessions. And now he's doing Leah and Louise, a great restaurant that opened at one of the most strenuous times in our country's history during COVID. And when were you originally set to open Leah and Louise?
So we literally opened on the day that that there was the announcement that you can only have 10 people inside the space. That was our opening day. We had friends and family, media night right before that. Everything went great. People were really comfortable. Everything was fine. And then the next day, the announcement dropped. So instead of opening that Friday, we ended up doing, carry out, take out to go. And then once, everything happened and we kind of went through our process, we got back to phase two and we opened June 12th of this year. So our opening was delayed 90 days. I mean, we had full staff. We had ordered all the food. The recipes were ready to go. The menu was great. We had everything ready to go. And then the ball dropped. We had to like completely pivot from dine-in to all carry out, curbside, takeout. In the midst of that, we even went from doing a 5 to 9 dinner service to 12 to 7 kind of like lunch dinner service, mm-hmm. and family style meals. Like we did everything to kind of pivot to try to give people the opportunity to see what we were and see what we did. But nothing is like opening that restaurant and having people sitting in the space or outside on the patio. It's been a great experience to kind of see the whole thing come to fruition.
So you in learning how to pivot and certainly understanding what the menu was. So is the menu when you had to pivot, was that far different from the menu that you currently were you were opening the next day? How quickly did you have to change the menu and make adjustments to from dine-in service to carry out?
So I think we're fortunate, Sabrina and I are fortunate that we've been able to create a community in Charlotte of, chefs, restaurateurs, and even, consumers who, customers, they just want to come in and support us. So our first 2 weeks, we kept the same menu. We didn't change anything. It was a little less refined. We're not putting micros into go plates and we're not doing different oils and stuff onto goes, but we served the same menu and we kind of got feedback and we understood what it was. And a lot of people kept asking, are y'all going to do family style meals? And once that happened, that happened 20 or 30 times. I'm like, well, yeah, we're doing family style meals. So we did family style meals. And then we even went to, one of the discussions that we had about looking at soul food and not necessarily saying, well, I got to refine soul food. It doesn't need to be refined. We could just present it in a way and add that technique, like you said, with frying chicken, doing fried fish. My fried fish recipe is essentially the same fried fish recipe in the Soul Cookbook with a couple of, a couple of tweaks or whatever. But we did that. And then we even did on Sundays, we did celebration suppers to where we would do fish and spaghetti or we do fried chicken with barbecue field peas or whatever. So we shifted as much as the clientele wanted us to shift. We did donut days where one of my pastry chef would just come in and do different types of donut per the season. So we shifted as much as we could shift with the understanding that at some point we were going to have to go back to what we initially started with. So for example, we got oxtail and dumplings on the menu, right? It's oxtail with red rice collards. We took that same oxtail stew, cooked the liquid down, and we made oxtail tacos for lunch when we flipped. So we kind of kept a lot of the same ingredients on the menu. We just changed the way we put them out and gave them to people.
So from a financial standpoint, and I'm sure listeners are going to be curious about this, you're expecting to have a certain average check. You definitely said you already hired all the labor that you needed for the restaurant. You already had food in it. and not revealing too much of the inner circles of the business, but how much did it pivot, cost you in general from what you budgeted to? And then how, you know, do you feel about the recovery from that now with phase two being reopened? And just give a little listeners a understanding. Phase one was when you, Charlotte said, shut everything down and you only have 10 people, and phase two opened it up for more dine-in services.
Right. So, so phase one happened, and obviously it was devastating for everybody who had a restaurant, was opening a restaurant. I guess this is just us trying to find a silver lining. We never knew how much we really could do. So we hadn't opened and we hadn't had, 100 covers a night. Like, so we really never understood how busy we could be. So, when you open a restaurant, a lot of people overhire. We kind of underhired because I felt like a lot of my salary positions could kind of, find out what that could fit in and what that could do different to kind of help us from a labor perspective. And also to kind of say, well, listen, if y'all want to make, salary, find out things that you could do and be more beneficial. So from that standpoint, we started at a better place than some places. The interesting thing about it was we went from our first day we opened, we did like nothing crazy. We got 50 seats. We did like $2,000. So that's essentially like a $40 per person check average at 50 seats, right? The next week, that same day, we dropped by 66%. So we did a $2,000 day on a Friday, it's $2,500 on a Saturday, and then next weekend we did like $700. So I was like, wow, like that's what gave me the impetus to kind of understand that we needed to change the menu, right? Because people weren't looking for fine dining. People were looking for smoked chicken, two sides, and four biscuits, right? They needed food to feed a family at home. So that's one thing. I think the second thing to understand is if I got people on salary, right? And my sous chef's making, around $40,000 or whatever, I have to figure out, whether I can afford to pay them that. And my quick understanding was we couldn't afford to pay them that. Uptown Yoke, our breakfast restaurant, that's in a food hall you've been in, right? The whole food hall shut down. So we couldn't operate Uptown Yoke even if we wanted to operate Uptown Yoke. So we had to let everybody know, hey, look, we're not going to be able to do that. One of the things we did at Uptown Yoke was we reached out to a nonprofit that was already trying to figure out how to feed people. So they raised money. They raised money. We worked with U.S. Foods. They actually provided food for donated food for free. We did 200 breakfasts 5 days a week out of Uptown Yoke for this community through an organization called Hill Charlotte. So one of the things we pivoted on at the breakfast restaurant, we were able to do 1,000 breakfasts a week and pay two of our staff members, my kitchen manager and my front of the house manager over there for, I want to say, 2 months. At Lee and Louise, we did some frontline food stuff. So, I mean, we one of the things that allowed us to pay people was kind of, reaching out and paying, making meals for the frontline workers and communities. And that allowed us to pay people. We're really lucky at both restaurants. We were able to get PPP loans. And a lot of people couldn't get them. And we also lucky at Lee and Louise that I had one staff member that didn't get unemployment. And I mean full 100% unemployment with the $600 and everything. So we were very lucky in both situations to be able to have relationships to where we could, pay our employees through charity and, reach out to the community and feed the community as well. So we were just fortunate in that way that financially we stayed at an okay place. On the other side of this, it's going to be interesting because right now we're at about 75% of what we projected we were going to be able to do. Last month, my labor cost was like 50%.
That is devastating for a restaurant at 50%.
Insane, because your prime costs are supposed to be 60%, right? So right. My labor alone was at 50%. Like, yeah. I mean, we had a meeting and I was like, this is not, well, I'm not going to say what I said in that meeting, but once we had a conversation and kind of figured out some things, we went from 50% last month. Currently, we're at 35%, which is a huge drop from 50%, and we're working on some things to kind of get that closer to 30%. But it's just crazy to try to figure out because the projections don't mean anything.
They usually never will.
They mean nothing. You could guess at it, but you like 15 points You know what I mean? We were 15 points off. And I think people don't understand that when we're talking about, you know, people coming in for reservations and not canceling and tipping well. All those things are important, regular restaurant industry. But right now, it's so important for people to come in for their reservations and not cancel, because if I'm thinking we're going to do 80, 100 people, my staff is set up to do 80 people. So if we drop off to 40 people, I got to figure out what to do, because now I got managers there that I don't need to have. I got buses there that I don't need to have. So all like it's important for everybody to, you know.
Let me interject here and just ask you another quick question. We got about 5 minutes left here. You know, you mentioned labor costs, food costs, you know, rents, everything else. But in that, I did not hear you say anything about necessarily cooking. And one thing that I believe is the biggest fallacy about what chefs actually do when they get to your level, my level, or anyone who is an owner of a restaurant, that cooking really becomes one of the last things that you have to consume yourself with. How do you manage the time in between cooking and actually operating the business?
Man, Chef, one of the, you know, every time we talk and we get together, the conversation is about, you know, we talk about flavors, we talk about technique, we talk about, you know, plates, and we talk about different things, but we really talk about running a business because, like you said, the fallacy is that we just get to come in to work, you know, cook with, play with a lot of different food and do all these techniques and, you know, just have fun and kind of, you know, smack in the kitchen.
You know, talk to the farmers, talk to the...
Right. Go to the farmers markets in the morning, kind of skip around with our burlap bags, but that ain't what it is. You know what I mean? Like, I usually get to work and we open at 5 p.m. I usually get to work at 9 a.m. I come in, I cut everything on, kind of see what the prep's looking like, and then I go pull out my laptop. I'm usually on my laptop responding to emails, looking at numbers, you know, trying to put out fires, doing projections for the day, for the week, for the hour even, right? And then I probably don't actually start cooking until about 1. But about 1, I cook. You know, my sous chef comes in, we talk about things. And then a couple hours later, my junior sous comes in and we talk about stuff. But I don't really, I probably taste more food than I actually cook. And then I'm on a computer until like 4:30, we do line up, and then I'm expoing, and I do a little cooking from 5 to 9. But more than anything, I'm just kind of executing the stuff that we've already cooked and prepared, or that my crew's already cooked and prepared. Like I spend, and that's what's crazy. As you grow, you cook less. As you get kind of up in ranks or whatever, when you go from, you know, sous chef to CDC to executive chef, you cook a lot less. I cook now. I try to cook at home a little bit, but even cooking at home today, like I'm doing, you know, I'm honored to be on the podcast with y'all. My wife was just on the podcast earlier. After we get done with this, we're probably going to go to Lowe's and fix some stuff at the restaurant. I'm not going to cook anything over the next couple of days. So I love cooking. Cooking is my passion. But what I realize more is feeding people is my passion, not necessarily cooking. And, you know, mentoring and trying to educate people is also more of a passion. And I can't be a mentor if I don't run a good business.
Absolutely. And I know that you have some great recipes in your head and great food in your head, but also developing people to cook those is probably the most difficult job or unsung job that people think that chefs naturally have to do. But because we manage so many things at one given time, it might be, you know, just misconstrued that we have all this free time in the world, which we do not. The last, you know, final, you know, question here, I just want to, you know, briefly ask you about is really, you know, what is the future? And I want to kind of, you know, force this question this way, is what is the future of opening more restaurants with a husband and wife team in which you all both are now consumed with this one project? And where does the separation, you know, come back? Or are you even allowed to separate yourselves from the restaurant at all?
I think the thing, Sabrina and I have been fortunate, and I keep saying it, we've been fortunate to have, as we grow in the industry, a lot of husband and wife couples who are in the restaurant industry and just who just are able to help us take steps or help us understand how to decompress from the restaurant. When we first opened, I didn't see a vacation. There's no way. We've been open for Lee and Luis. We've been open, I'll say since March, but we've gone and taken vacations. And vacations could be nothing but driving down to Atlanta to hang out for a couple days, driving up to Wilmington to hang out for a couple days. It's not really like we're on the beach or all in hotel rooms or anything. It's just like driving for a couple days and going, you know, hanging out with friends and family just to kind of decompress from the restaurant. I think that's one of the biggest things that we've learned is that we love what we do. I'm always thinking about restaurants. I'm always thinking about growing. So from one side of it, as we've gotten older, I think we learn more about who we are as individuals. So when we go to restaurants and we think about building, we kind of think, hey, Sabrina, what do you want to do with the restaurant world? Hey, babe, hey, Greg, what do you want to do with the restaurant world, right? So we ask ourselves those questions individually and collectively, for one. And for two, as far as the future of restaurants goes, everything that we're thinking about doing now is not quick service, but in the grain of quick service, fast casual, being able to cook a great product consistently for a mass amount of people without having to have them be in my space the whole time. Another thing we're thinking about is the next project we got going on. We're going to have a patio space, right? It's going to be a huge patio space that's able to seat people for four seasons, and that's going to be our dining area. We're Absolutely. Not necessarily thinking about doing a bunch of seats on the inside. We're automatically thinking patio seating, 6 feet spaced apart. If I can add seats, if you know, in 2 years, everything's great, everybody wants to sit next to each other again, great, we can add seats. But we're thinking about right now, we're operating like everything is going to be phase one from here on out. So if we can adjust, we can always adjust to add more seats. So we can adjust to add more menu. We can adjust to add more refinement. But it's hard to go from extremely refined 30 seats where everybody's sitting at the same table together to try to make that make sense where now you can only sit five people at the same table to set 30 seats. So we're looking at everything like we're in phase one.
I mean, definitely the math, you know, doesn't add up when you have to construct a restaurant that way. We don't know when it's going to change, and certainly in this political climate, we don't know if anything's going to change until after the election. Would you tell everyone where they can find you on social media?
All right, boo. So on Facebook and Instagram, you can find us at Uptown Yolk for the breakfast spot. Leah and Luis CLT on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter and all that good stuff. And then my personal is Chef Greg Collier 10 on Instagram, Gregory Collier on Facebook, Soul Food Session CLT on Instagram and Facebook. And at some point, I'm going to try to figure out how to get Todd and the crew together so we can, you know, cook some good food for the people again. I know you're busy. You just opened a barbecue spot. How y'all doing there, by the way?
It is great. We talk good. About having a patio. Good. We have 60 seats on our patio. It is great. But, you know, we are growing as well. And we're looking forward as well to have you down here to do our chef series here. And it's really great on the patio to see it in its fruition. Well, my friend, no more of a youngin. I think you might get into that, not OG, you might get to that G category right now. Not that OG category, you know, yet you got to get a little more aches and pains when you get up and out the bed, you know, in order to get to the OG category.
Well, listen, once y'all triple OGs, then I can be an OG. So y'all got to get to the triple, then I can go up to the OG spot.
Hey, you know, what did Darth said, you know, I was once the student, but now I'm the master, you know, that's the way to be. Give your best to your wife, the best of the two, just like mine is, as you all know. 100%. And I thank Gregory Collier for coming on Soul by Todd Richards. And I look forward to talking to everyone soon. Thank you very much.
Peace.
Soul by Todd Richards is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of Food World's most innovative community? Subscribe to shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.